Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing organ donation after voluntary assisted dying. We'll be asking, how feasible is it in Australia, and what kind of legal and operational considerations are there? My special guests are Associate Professor Neera Bhatia at Deakin Law School and Associate Professor James Tibbles, a retired intensive care physician. You can read about their research in the Medical Journal of Australia by clicking the link in the podcast description. Associate Professor Bhatia and Associate Professor Tibbles, thank you so much for joining me today.
A pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Associate Professor Bhatia, I'll begin with you. Can you take us through the findings of your research?
Sure. So what we found is that there is international practice of organ donation following euthanasia in Europe, as it's referred to, currently performed in Belgium, the Netherlands, Spain, and Canada. And that is where organ donation can occur, and it can occur after euthanasia. And we found that it has been successful overseas. And our research has looked at voluntary assisted dying, as it's referred to in Australia. And we know that all Australian states have passed voluntary assisted dying legislation in Australia. There's also space for voluntary assisted dying legislation to be passed in the territories in Australia. And to our mind, there's no reason why there should be any legal impediments for organ donation following voluntary assisted dying to also be practiced in Australia. So our paper looks at an international perspective and an international practice, and we look at the practical and logistical processes of organ donation following euthanasia overseas. And we also look at the voluntary assisted dying landscape, legal landscape in Australia. And we found that while there is varying legislation across different states in Australia in relation to voluntary assisted dying, there are many nuances that have to be taken into account.
And I'll go to Associate Professor Tibbles now. You've spent many years as an intensive care physician in Melbourne. What prompted you and your colleagues to conduct this research?
We have realised for a long time that there is a shortage of organ donors. There are many patients on an organ recipient waiting list. And we know from a day-to-day experience that there is a big gap between the number of organs available, which is small, and recipients waiting for them, which is large. We are always looking for opportunities from very generous people who want to gift their organs, either by their own declaration or from the relatives. And so we want to take advantage of that and try and assist those people who are in need.
And Professor Tibbles, from a medical perspective, what are the risks with donating organs from someone who has died using voluntary assisted dying medications?
Concerning medications, there is really no problem. The person who is assisted to die would be given a short-acting anaesthetic agent like thiopentone or short-acting barbiturate or propofol, another short-acting anaesthetic induction agent, which renders them unconscious within a number of seconds to a minute or perhaps, and then that drug is followed by the administration of a muscle relaxant, and now the unfortunate person is deeply unconscious, and because they become hypoxemic and hypotensive very quickly, their heart will stop beating. Now, those drugs which are present in the donor's body would normally be metabolized and excreted within a number of minutes, but in this particular circumstances, those drugs might remain in the system of the donor. But in the end, that is of no consequence because the recipient who's about to receive the organ would probably be given the same drugs anyway for the purpose of general anaesthesia in order to receive the organ. So the drugs which remain in the donor's body, in their organs, would be have a very small contribution to the same medications or very similar medications given to the recipient, and the recipient would be under general anaesthesia, and so there would be little, if any, additive effect of the drugs remaining in the organ.
And I understand consent is a big topic. Professor Tibbles, we need to ensure that relatives give their consent for this to happen.
Okay, this is a very important subject, and it's already practiced in the present day organ donation scenario. For example, when a person has agreed to be an organ donor before they die, irrespective of whether they have agreed or have not agreed to organ donation, the relatives are always consulted. They seem to have the power of veto over organ procurement, even if the unfortunate patient had expressed a desire to donate organs before their death. It's not a legal obligation in that particular scenario. We have previously recognised a common law right in a previous publication, a common law right of a property over a dead body. And we think that, but in this particular circumstance, we do think that there is a property right held by the relatives, irrespective of what the organ donor had wanted. And we think that those relatives should be consulted.
And another consideration, I'm sure, is obviously making sure that only healthy organs are donated.
A person can only access voluntary assisted dying if they are afflicted with a condition is likely to be fatal within 6 months or within 12 months in certain neurodegenerative conditions. But that does not mean to say that other organs in their body will not be fully functional if they're transplanted into a recipient. But there are certain conditions in which organs would not be procured because they wouldn't be suitable for a potential recipient. Patients with many different types of cancers are not suitable to donate organs, but it's on a case-by-case basis.
Associate Professor Bhatia, I'll go to you now. You mentioned in your introduction that this was feasible in Australia. How common is organ donation after voluntary assisted dying overseas?
From our statistics, we know that from 2012 through to January 2022, organ donation after euthanasia was performed 85 times in the Netherlands. In Spain, it took a little bit of time for some traction. In 2021, organ donation after euthanasia was only performed in 7 cases. However, the following year, so within the space of a year, organ donation after euthanasia was performed 42 times. So that's quite a considerable jump, I'd say. Canada is another country where organ donation after euthanasia has occurred, is occurring, and that was our statistics in our paper report. From 2016 to 2021, 136 patients donated organs after medical assistance in dying, as it's referred to in Canada. And Belgium as well, there were 50 patients that donated their organs following euthanasia between 2011 and 2020. We don't have any figures for Australia. This is something that we have proposed in our paper, that we don't see any impediments for this occurring in Australia and this practice being performed in Australia. But we can see there's some steady figures from overseas.
I want to zoom in now at the practicalities of making this happen in Australia at both an operational and a legal level. Neera, from a legal perspective, what kind of changes need to occur?
With anything as important as this, we know that there has to be good governance. And good governance is important for the protection of all people involved. So, again, in our paper, we talk about the need for national guidelines. There's a need for guidelines, and this would require the assistance and the guidance of the Organ and Tissue Authority. We talk about national guidelines in our paper, and our paper discusses 4 essential elements. And the first is that there must be adherence to the legal definition of death. We talk about the need for adherence to each state and territory-based voluntary assisted legislation and adherence to the national guidelines for organ donation after circulatory death, which again, for the purposes of that third requirement, it would require discussion about informed consent to organ donation before voluntary assisted dying occurs, and consent of the closest relative. And that's a really important point in relation to organ donation. And the consent of the next of kin is particularly important. To your point, national guidelines are important, but they must also be implemented into law. And if they're not implemented into law, then they don't really stand for much. So there has to be an implementation into incorporation into legislation. Clinical guidelines must be incorporated into legislation, otherwise they're not legally binding. So that's particularly important.
And James, asking from an operational level, what do you need to see from a medical point of view?
There are some major differences compared to what happens at the moment, which is when a person dies from or dies with irreversible cessation of the circulation. That usually occurs in the situation where a patient's condition is futile, or hopeless rather, and further treatment is futile. And that person usually is in a situation where life support is withdrawn, and by that I mean often mechanical ventilation and or the use of inotropic drugs, that those treatments are stopped. And then if there's any distress, suffering or pain experienced by the patient, the doctors are able to give sedative agents to alleviate that pain, distress or suffering. It is not their intention to cause the death of the patient, but often death does occur as a secondary effect in order to relieve that pain, distress or suffering. If the person dies within a set period of time and they have or their relatives have agreed to organ donation from that person, they are taken to the operating theatre where the organs are procured and transplanted immediately into people who are waiting to receive those organs. So that's a little bit different to organ donation after voluntary assisted dying, where the intention is different. It is actually to cause the person to die. And in order to do that, the same drugs would be sedative drugs would be used along with a muscle relaxant, which is different in the case of donation after circulatory death. In order to do that, special training of the physician who is going to administer those drugs needs to be undertaken, because the process is a little bit different, but still would happen in the intensive care environment. That would be the preferable place for this to occur. So that they need to undertake training. And secondly, remember that in the case of donation after circulatory death, there has developed a relationship between the doctor and the patient, whereas in voluntary assisted dying, there is usually no relationship, or would there not be? There would not be a relationship between the patient and the doctor, which is understandably quite different. It's usually, if organ donation weren't contemplated, it would be perhaps the general practitioner that the patient knows very well who would administer those drugs in a particular setting. But here, the situation is that those drugs would probably be given by someone from the intensive care unit in different circumstances, and they would have to undergo a special training in order to qualify to be able to give those drugs to cause assisted dying. That change needs to be thought about quite deeply, and hospitals, institutions need to come to grips with that. Who would give the drugs and what relationship would they have with the patient who wants to die? So it is somewhat different.
And Neera, what's the importance of encouraging organ donation after voluntary assisted dying?
It's important for a number of reasons. And I think if we look at it from the perspective of a person who is seeking to donate their organs, it's also from a sense of, I guess, autonomy in their decision-making. If a person has made a really important decision to opt for voluntary assisted dying, which is dying with dignity, and they meet that eligibility criteria, and then they also wish to donate their organs after knowing that they independently and separately meet the eligibility criteria for voluntary assisted dying, if they can then go on to assist another person after their death, I think we should be assisting in any way that we can for this to occur. And I think that is not only respecting the dying person's wishes, but it's also assisting a living person to go on and live, hopefully, a fruitful life. And I think at a state level, it's important for governments to assist in that process, as well as from an institutional level, as Jim has discussed, to try and assist in making that possible.
James, would you like to comment on that?
There would be a relatively small number of people who would be willing to probably to donate their organs after a voluntary assisted dying, but that small number might make a huge difference to those people on a recipient waiting list. They might be small in number, but they could assist many people, perhaps up to five or six at each time to receive an essential organ. So it's a very important thing for them, for our healthcare system to consider very carefully and to support wherever possible those involved in this particular scenario.
Well said. Associate Professor Neera Bhatia and Associate Professor James Tibbles, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
My special guests have been Associate Professor Neera Bhatia at Deakin Law School and Associate Professor James Tibbles, a retired intensive care physician. You can read their research in the Medical Journal of Australia by clicking on the link in the description of this podcast. You can find more podcasts from the Medical Journal of Australia on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.